This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Send them all to jail. Expel the kids.
Cancel the science. Send home those negative naysayers frightening our kids. That is Washington's solution for climate change. California's climate scientist and WeatherWest blogger Daniel Swain covers the latest U.S. purge of weather and climate science. But first, a new public health study about your body. How much heat before lasting damage kicks in? From the T.H. Chan School of Public Health at Harvard, Dr. Robert Mead on how heat kills. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm your guide, Alex Smith. In these days, disruption of human affairs competes with disruption of nature. Who can pay attention to it all? Superheat is here, but it is not evenly distributed. In mid-April, summer arrived in Eastern Europe, while Spain was kind of chilly. The U.S. Southwest baked in 100-plus degrees temperatures, 38°C, while snow fell in Ontario, Canada, to Albany, New York, and Maine.
Australia has experienced its hottest 12-month period on record, ending with its hottest March on record. With last month seeing temperatures 2.41 C above average, the Bureau of Meteorology has confirmed.
41 degrees C, about 106 Fahrenheit in the shade on the southern coast of Australia, April 13th. That is a summer heat wave in the fall in Australia. All the Pacific islands of Oceania are suffering through heat, and it doesn't cool down enough at night. South China is way too hot. Northern India is roasting. We will hear more about that soon with Robert Mead, who was just there. And so what we see across multiple continents, not a consistent warming of the world, but strange alternating waves of extreme unseasonal heat in one place and colder than usual in another. The total is still warmer than ever, of course, but it is not evenly distributed. This confuses us humans.
Winter is now spring. Goes from cold snaps to heat waves, or a month of rain overnight. Welcome to the new world.
Hurricanes and wildfires get the headlines, but the real killer of climate change is barely reported. Extreme heat is killing millions of people around the world. Over 50,000 dead in one European heat wave, and thousands even in northern countries like Russia and Canada. In the tropics, where it's worst, we do not have accurate figures. So it is shocking to find out we are not even sure what the safe levels of heat and humidity are. Do you know your limit? Dr. Robert Mead leads a team of scientists trying to find out. Mead is a postdoctoral research fellow in epidemiology at Harvard's well-known T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He is lead author of the March 31st paper in PNAS titled Validating New Limits for Human Thermoregulation. From Massachusetts, Robert Mead, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Alex, thanks for having me on.
As we speak in the middle of April, in northern India and Pakistan, temperatures are soaring up to 49 degrees Celsius, 120 Fahrenheit, and that's 8 degrees above normal. In the northwestern Indian city of Ahmedabad, with 7.5 million people at least, the temperature is already well over 100 degrees Fahrenheit daily, and forecast to break 40 degrees C soon, weeks ahead of normal for this time of year. Robert, you recently returned from Ahmedabad. What were you doing there?
Yeah, so our team here at Harvard at the Salada Institute for Climate and Sustainability, South Asia Cluster, we're running a kind of first-of-its-kind long-term study evaluating not just how people experience heat kind of at the workplace or during kind of peak heat wave conditions, but throughout the course of an entire year. So we're working with the Self-Employed Women's Association, which is a central trade union in India representing more than 3 million women working in the informal sector in India. Now, this is came as a surprise to me when I started the study, but over 90% of India's workforce is informal, so they fall outside the kind of normal workplace regulations. And we're instrumenting their homes and workplaces with temperature sensors. We're providing them with wearable monitors, taking regular measurements of things like kidney function to really ascertain, you know, how is it that these women are exposed to heat throughout the course of an entire year, and then how does that affect their health, their well-being, their earnings, etc.
Okay, so to get to the basics, to gauge heat danger, experts use a measurement that combines both heat and humidity. It is called the wet bulb temperature, which mystifies most of us. Why do we need to know both heat and humidity?
Yeah, so the key reason behind needing to also understand the humidity someone is exposed to is because the primary autonomic or physiological way that humans dissipate heat to maintain core temperature within safe limits is through sweating. Now, it's actually the evaporation of that sweat that does the cooling. So if we can't evaporate sweat, it just drips off our body, and it doesn't provide any sort of cooling benefit, any heat dissipation from the body. So when there's a lot of moisture in the air, which is registered as a high humidity or a high wet bulb temperature, it basically tells us that our drive for sweat evaporation from the skin is reduced, and therefore the level of heat stress actually experienced by the body is going to increase, even if air temperatures are relatively low.
Well, everybody needs to understand our body is not a quick heat mirror, and I learned that mainly from your paper. The essential core temperature around key organs takes hours to lose control and break down, so it isn't the quick dash to the local store that kills us. Robert, tell us about heat, humidity, and how long we can tolerate exposure.
Yeah, so this is kind of a multifaceted question, and I think we're going to get into this in a little bit, but we can think of heat stress in kind of two ways, and thermal physiologists like myself often kind of categorize heat stress into what we would call compensable and uncompensable heat stress. Now, this is exactly what it sounds like, is the body able to compensate for the level of heat it is experiencing? So in a compensable heat stress, and we think of this in terms of wet bulb limits, these are basically scenarios in which the body is gaining so much heat, whether it be through metabolism or a hot environment, or just that we can't dissipate enough heat. So we're gaining so much heat that we can't offset this with heat loss, that our core temperature is just going to stream up and up and up. And in these environments, heat stroke can be reached relatively rapidly, you know, even within 3 to 6 hours, depending on the level of heat stress we're experiencing. Now, by contrast, even when we're in conditions where our body temperature can work as expected, so we would call this compensable heat stress, the body can compensate for the level of heat stress, maintaining a stable internal temperature, even if conditions are, you know, moderate to hot, requires that our body actually sustain some level of strain. So our core temperature needs to be elevated to activate sweating. Our heart has to beat harder to help facilitate blood distribution to the skin. And we're also losing fluid, becoming dehydrated. Now, in these environments, we're more and more convinced that it's not necessarily the acute level of heat stress that can cause injury or death. It's potentially the prolonged heat stress over multiple days. If you think of a heat wave lasting, you know, as many as 3 to 6 to a week to even months, as we've seen in Phoenix last year. But this kind of consistent strain on the physiological systems can set us up for failure, particularly in individuals who are already vulnerable. So for, you can think of people with clinical conditions like heart disease, diabetes, whose maybe internal systems just can't shoulder that level of heat for extended periods.
And also interesting in your study, our bodies manage to cope with heat for a while, and then rather suddenly the core temperature goes up. It's almost like there's a tipping point inside us. What does that tell us?
So this is what we think of, this kind of tipping point in the study. In the context of this was we're exposing the participants to a given level of air temperature, and then we're slowly ramping up humidity. And what we see is that core temperature is stable for some period, and then it inflects and starts to increase rather rapidly. And this is what we take as the border between those conditions I was mentioning, compensable versus uncompensable heat stress. The border of conditions where the body is able to maintain core temperature, and then the conditions in which the uncompensable heat stress, which it just can't, and core temperature starts to increase rapidly.
In a way, I think of heat danger a little bit like fire risk. When it's really hot, fire risk increases, but it takes ignition to become a fire, like, you know, lightning or arson or something. And it can be very hot with high conditions, and yet it's not too bad if the humidity isn't too high. So we have heat waves and we have humidity waves like atmospheric rivers, But maybe the two collide and combine and we have killer heat humidity waves? Is that possible? And what would we call that?
So I think this is the idea behind the concern about extremely elevated wet bulb temperatures into the future. So we know some areas of the planet are, I mean, most of the planet is increasing in temperature, and humidity is actually increasing a little bit quicker than temperature in some areas. And in certain regions, particularly in, you know, North Africa and South Asia, including India, we are seeing these wet bulb temperatures, these combinations of air temperature and humidity approaching what we might consider limits for human thermoregulation. So this is, of course, if this is in fact occurring, very concerning for health and safety in these areas.
Yeah, even parts of the Middle East right along the Red Sea there have higher humidity than you would expect for a desert, and they're in danger of going beyond survivability if you don't have air conditioning. So we spoke about extreme heat with Greek scholar Dr. Matt Santamouris. He told us heat tolerance also depends on prior experience. For example, when it's 96 degrees in Athens, Fahrenheit, or 35 C, there's no increase in visits to the emergency department. People kind of expect that, but even 32 degrees C or lower, 90 degrees in the United Kingdom, more people go to the emergency ward due to heat-related problems. What do you think about cultural adaptation and heat safety?
Yeah, so this is actually a really important question and something that we need to explore more and more. As you mentioned, we know that in areas that are generally hotter, the thresholds for when we start to see hospitalizations, when we start to see heat-related deaths, are typically at higher temperatures. Now, this could be due to a whole host of different factors. We know that a body exposed to heat for even just a couple weeks will start to sweat earlier, kind of regulate core temperature at a lower value, even at rest. And these are kind of the hallmark signs of acclimatization. A big part of our response to heat is behavior. So people in hot regions, rather, when it becomes hot, they already have some idea of, you know, what to do to stay cool. And then also the way we design cities. So, you know, I'm Canadian, and thing with heat in Canada is it doesn't get quite so hot. But because of the way homes are designed, is once the heat gets indoors, it stays trapped indoors. You know, we're used to dealing with cold temperatures, so this means designing our houses in such a way that kind of lock heat inside. Now, where this becomes really important in the context of this discussion around wet bulb temperature limits is that most of our understanding of critical limits for thermoregulation, or when conditions become too hot to regulate body temperature, has come out of laboratory studies in areas that are not those facing the most severe increases in wet bulb temperature. So we have our study, which was performed in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, the Veselio study, which gets quoted quite a bit, and we based our study off of, which was in Pennsylvania. And even the models that we now have emerging that are used to estimate limits without having to expose people to these hot laboratory conditions were developed with inputs from more temperate climates, North America, Europe, places like this. So I think there's still a bit of an open question on, even when we just think about the physiological limits for heat exposure, you know, are these reflective, are our current estimates reflective of individuals in the places that we see these really high wet bulb temperatures starting to emerge?
So is increased violence and suicides during heat waves a myth or not?
As far as my understanding of the epidemiological literature, you do see for every increase in mean daily temperature, mean max or daily max temperature, an increase in reports of violence, completed suicides, etc. So I don't think this is a myth. I think this is occurring, yes.
Well, I ask that question because the media will focus on heat deaths, but damages from prolonged heat could extend much further. In 2017, Dr. Camila Mora from the University of Hawaii talked to us about his paper, 27 Ways a Heat Wave Can Kill You. Yes. Among many studies, he found extreme heat wave can damage major organs, and that might not kill us right away, but it could shorten our life later. What are your thoughts on this sort of extended life of heat waves?
Yeah, so this is actually a big goal of our group here at the Salata Institute, including in this study in Ahmedabad mentioned up top, is really thinking about not just heat-related deaths, but also all the cascading ways that heat can influence lives and livelihoods. So just kind of going top to bottom, I mean, when we think about these wet bulb temperature limits, again, it's really, you know, clear line in the sand. the conditions above which heat stroke develops rapidly and below which body temperature regulation can occur as planned. But even below these critical limits, you know, we still see cardiovascular strain, we still see strain on the kidneys, and this probably explains why heat waves kill more people through cardiovascular events than heat stroke. And for workers, thinking particularly of sugarcane workers, Mesoamerica, you do see increasing reports of chronic kidney disease that is most likely caused by prolonged exposure. And then even moving out from there, all these kind of downstream and secondary effects, increases in interpersonal violence, declines in mental health. And these can occur through a whole host of mechanisms we don't really understand currently. So in terms of the study we're doing in Ahmedabad, you know, if you're making a daily wage based on how much you can produce in a day and you're not able to work because it's hot, this decrease in earnings can have, you know, very cascading effects on food security, on ability to afford medication, on anxiety. So we're just now beginning to think about and really study how heat affects people, not just peak days during a heat wave, but when it's sustained over multiple days, multiple weeks, and through all these kind of secondary and insidious pathways.
Yeah, we're learning about long COVID, but I don't think most doctors or public health planners or any of us are aware of long heat. Why not?
I think historically, heat waves have been very hard to study for a couple of reasons, particularly the health effects of heat waves. For the longest time, it was very, not rare, but relatively rare to have a heat wave in any particular place. So your kind of studies on heat waves were a little bit opportunistic in the sense that, you know, you had to have data collection system, whether it be through medical records or even physiological studies, in place the time a heat wave hit. We didn't have the situation like we have now where we can, you know, bet pretty well that a heat wave is going to occur in, you know, most places around the planet in any given summer. The other side of the equation is that the attributing health impacts to heat waves is very difficult. And even things like heat-related deaths often kind of get missed in medical records. And this is because, as we've kind of been discussing, it's not just that you necessarily die from heat stroke. It's some cardiovascular event, it's maybe a kidney injury that is brought on by heat. But you show up to the emergency room or, you know, maybe the coroner, and there's no clear sign that this was, you know, triggered directly by the heat wave. So often, you know, on death certificates, you just get records like cardiovascular event, cardiopulmonary event, and then the fact that this was caused or at least triggered by heat gets lost.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. Ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. You're listening to Dr. Robert Mead from the Harvard Chan Center. We are talking about underestimated health risk during high heat and humidity, especially in a warming world. Your study found slow changes in body core temperature also mean it can take hours to cool down after exposure to hot, muggy weather. We pay attention to daytime highs, but tend to discount hotter nights. At least one expert suggested night conditions are key to letting the body cool down during a heat wave. Talk about night heat and humidity.
Yes. So more and more we're starting to understand the importance of not just the, like you said, peak daytime temperatures, but also high nighttime temperatures. We know that nighttime temperatures, even independent of daytime temperatures, are associated with increased health impacts of heat in the epidemiological literature. There's a lot of studies being done currently to assess this. But I think the key theory here is that, you know, if we're exposed to heat in the day, whether, you know, we're working outside or we're exposed to an overheated home, the night is where we're supposed to be able to cool down so we can, you know, open our windows, let the cold air in and get some reprieve, let our physiological system, let our bodies recover for that next day of exposure. Now, if nighttime conditions remain high, and we certainly see in India that home temperatures, because of the way they're designed, you know, you have poorly insulated and ill-ventilated homes that just trap heat inside. They stay very warm overnight. So if you're, you know, trying to recover in conditions that remain hot, you're basically setting yourself up for disaster the next day because you're exposed to that same heat wave, but you're starting from a kind of an already strained position.
Robert Mead, you also studied heat wave risks for older people. Talk to us about the challenges for seniors and their lower wet bulb heat tolerance.
Yeah, so a lot of my work at the University of Ottawa was done evaluating how older adults are impacted by heat. We did some of the first day-long heat exposure trials, so 9 hours of exposure to conditions similar to those experienced during heat waves in Canada. And there's a couple changes physiologically that occur as we age that increase our susceptibility to high temperatures. So on one side of the coin, our thermoregulation, our thermoregulatory function actually changes. So what we see in older adults is they have lower maximum sweat rates, so they're less able to increase evaporative heat loss. But the thermoregulatory system also shifts to higher temperatures. It takes a little bit longer for it to be activated when we're exposed to heat. So even when we can sweat enough to dissipate enough heat to maintain kind of a thermal balance or stable core temperatures, as we get older, that balance point occurs at higher and higher temperatures. So you can think of it, if we're exposed to, you know, 5 days of a heat wave, each day we're experiencing higher and higher temperatures in our body as we get older. Now, on the other side of the coin, we also see that as we age, you know, our cardiovascular function decreases, our kidney function decreases. So not only is it that older adults are kind of experiencing more heat strain, they're also potentially have, you know, physiological changes that reduce their resilience to that strain. And this is likely why we see increases in cardiovascular events, kidney injuries, et cetera, in older adults during heat waves.
In 2023, we spoke with University of Sydney Professor Adrienne Gordon. She specializes in heat safety for pregnant women. She found for each 1 degree C increase of heat brought a 5% increase in the risk of premature births in hot places and a 16% increase during heat waves. Who are the populations that need far more study before we can set true safety limits?
Yeah, so there are certainly a whole host of groups that we believe are at a higher risk of heat-related health events, as you mentioned, older adults as well as pregnant individuals. And vulnerability to heat kind of comes in two forms when we think about setting safety limits. So we have groups that are regularly exposed. So we think, for example, about outdoor workers or even indoor workers in hot, overheated factories, as well as individuals experiencing homelessness who, you know, can't often locate cool environments to cool off during heat waves. And then we have groups like older adults, like pregnant individuals, who, when they're exposed to heat, their physiology is perhaps not at as good of a place at dealing with that heat, whether it be due to declines in thermoregulatory function or the fact that they're also have a whole other host of physiological responsibilities. So we can think of pregnant individuals as, you know, their body is also having to deal with the pregnancy. So the heat is just an added stress on top of that. Now, we're starting to understand how heat impacts these groups. But I think where the need for new research is to really evaluating these effects kind of across the globe. A lot of our estimates, again, come from, cooler environments, North America, for example, where some of the most exposed and most vulnerable individuals are living in the global south, and we're not really sure how best to evaluate and protect individuals in these areas.
Yeah, part of the problem is we don't have that one-size-fits-all hard limit. What are public health experts doing? Can we create an easy chart where people can check to see if it's safe to go out and for how long, or do we need an app for that?
Yeah, this is, the million-dollar question. I know there are some apps being developed just looking at, you know, if you're going to go out and do certain physical activity or you're going to work, you know, these are the conditions or these are the temperatures it's safe to do so in. And certainly there are similar kind of lookup tables that are being used in occupational heat health guidance. I personally wonder whether there's ever going to be a universal kind of rule, particularly given the, you know, wide variation in conditions experienced across heat waves, the cascading and different ways that heat impacts the body, and just, you know, individual variation. We know that even if you look on paper, two individuals are the same stat, so to speak, they're the same age, same sex, on the same medication. You can bring them into a laboratory environment, put them in a climate chamber, and they might respond completely different ways to the heat. So my feeling is we're never going to be able to just plug someone's information into an app and then really get a sense of the true heat risk.
Well, as the planet heats up faster than expected with no barriers in sight, I'm stunned we're still playing catch-up with basic health knowledge that we all need. Let's wrap up with two things. What are you working on now, and what are the priorities for public health research in a warming world?
Yeah, so the main goal of the current work is, again, to kind of bring the studies you would typically do in a laboratory environment into the field. So speaking about this work in India, where we're measuring temperatures, humidities, physiological responses in workers over the course of an entire year. Most of the work we've done in thermal physiology to date has been conducted in a laboratory environment, which, of course, allows us a nice controlled location to kind of make these measurements, but really doesn't get at the nuances of everyday life. And I think similar studies, whether it be on pregnant individuals, outdoor workers, children, are needed to really evaluate how heat impacts people in the real world. And then from these, what the kind of, I think, main goal of most of this work should be is to then see how we can leverage this information and leverage these very unique data capture systems to then actually make assessments of the efficacy or effectiveness of different proposed strategies in the real world, in the individuals who are being exposed to heat. So for an example, you often hear about cool roofs. So painting the roof of houses white to reflect incoming solar radiation to cool down the indoor environment. Now, there have been some assessments of indoor temperature changes with cool roofs, but really not that much currently that is looked at. Well, how do these actual reductions in temperature, be it, you know, 1 degree, 2 degrees, 5 degrees, how do these impact the health of the exposed individuals? So kind of moving towards a way we can make these measurements and do these assessments in situ and in real life scenarios, I think is a very important goal for the future. I think certainly important to know, you know, when conditions become so hot for survival, but between, you know, normal, comfortable temperatures and those upper limits, there's this, we've been loosely referring to it as the zone of misery. So even if we're not at, you know, risk of health impacts or, you know, at high risk of health impacts, we still have to live our lives in these temperatures. And, you know, how it impacts quality of life, this is, I think, a very important question and one that should receive a lot more focus than it currently does.
It may be something that doctors and other public health experts can use on a regular basis to save lives in a warming world. We can hope for that. From Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, we've been speaking with Dr. Robert Mead. He led the new paper, Validating New Limits for Human Thermoregulation. Find links to that and a number of excellent articles on heat in India in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Robert, thank you for sharing your expertise with our listeners.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Dismantling of NOAA, NASA, and climate research accelerates. That was a live stream science update from climatologist Daniel Swain on April 14th, 2025. I bring you 27 minutes of key selections from the two-hour live stream. Search for the title on YouTube for the whole presentation or grab the link from my show blog, Dismantling of NOAA, NASA, and Climate Research Accelerates. Daniel Swain is a California-based communicator, often covering big storms, fires, and weather in the West. I was glued to his live stream reporting as wildfires burned into Los Angeles earlier this year. While mainstream media was fuzzy and hours late, Daniel swiveled through local cam shots of the fires, reports from the volunteer-sourced wildfire tracking app, Watch Duty. Then he tossed in official wind maps and weather forecasts. It was amazing, real-time coverage, and more amazing because Daniel was a bit sick at the time. He's just a fantastic mind, operating with a wide range of sources. Swain is still cool but disturbed in his live stream last week as he chronicles the dismantling of his world.
What I want to do is just summarize where we are now. And for those of you who've been following, the last time I had this conversation about on the policy side of what's going on, been talking about how there were large-scale cuts to, for example, the National